in order to make up the difference, the value that he got out of this sort of horror of losing money every tour, because he paid for everything. He paid for all the insurance. He paid for all the shipping. He paid all the salaries. He even paid the cost of renting all the equipment. Certainly the PA. Everything was his responsibility. So he'd always be down. I say we because it's our tax return. But we would always be down like $400,000 every year after a tour. It was always like for years it was that number. I don't know. It's like when I was in construction building things, it always cost $9,000. It was never $7,000 or six or five or 13. It was always, well, that'll cost $9,000. Why? You know, anyway, just it's one of those things like, you know, middle C. So he had to be able to ensure that anything from any time, anywhere, because what he had at the end of it was an invaluable collection of tapes. And those were the future, because it represented whatever the album was that was in release that they were promoting, and or the next set of albums, because they were always working on new material. And sometimes you get one shot at something that worked perfectly one night and not the next night or any subsequent night at all. But now you're dealing with what you, now you have these tapes and they turn into the cash that you're down. You know, so that's really, because Frank was one of those artists where you could sell concert tickets and albums, where either you had, most artists are one or the other. You can sell albums, but you can't sell concert tickets. Or you can sell concert tickets, but you can't sell albums. There's very few that do both. Although now, you know, now that the world is owned by corporate entities who control every venue, so they can say you can never work this planet again, they make things happen. Like, they sell artists like they sell presidents now, so there's hardly a difference. Either one of which could run the country. Either the president or that lead band leader. They could just swap them one night. Obama could be out there doing a Britney Spears tour. Thank you.
Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to episode 27 of the ZappaCast for January 2016. Happy New Year, boys and girls. This is a very special episode of the ZappaCast. We've been meaning to put this together for a while, but we wanted to pay tribute to the one, the only Mrs. Gail Zappa, who passed away back in September, and we just wanted to send her off with an appropriate farewell. In this episode, we have the whole gang back together, including our wonderful professor, Mr. Mick Eakers, who is back for his first roundtable in quite a while, and you'll hear from him in a little bit explaining where he's been all this time. So without any further ado, here we are paying tribute to Mrs. Gail Zappa, right here on the ZappaCast.
Now for the main event of this particular episode of the ZappaCast. Hail, hail, the gang's all here, because we've got everybody back together for the first time in a long time. So once again, live directly from his heart to you, the Reverend Andrew Greenaway.
Greetings.
Live from Chicago, and you know, all those sorts of things that happen in Illinois, Mr. Scott Fisher.
Hello.
Hello. And, of course, for the first time in a long, long time, straight out of the University of Bognor Regis, right?
Whatever his name is.
Yes. No, I was trying to think of what I used to say. Straight out of the University of Bognor Regis, folks, the professor himself, Mr. Mick Eakers.
Hello, everyone.
Hey! He's returned. All right, Mick, you should probably, first of all, if you can... tell us what, well, I don't even know if you can tell us where you've been, but, because a lot of people have asked, but, maybe you can make something up.
Right, yes, no, I've been busy, and I've been doing a lot of other things, perhaps not particularly Zappa-related, but,
You do things that aren't Zappa-related?
Yeah, funnily enough, I even have a day job, but, yeah, a lot of things going on. Including things like family weddings and stuff. So there was a lot of distractions this year anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm back now, and as forever, the plan is that the book will be out next year, as it always has been.
If it comes out in 2016, that means 2017.
Anyway, that's the plan. So good to be back.
Is the book finished?
Well, as I say, I need to do a little bit of re-engineering on it. There's been some new material come in over the past year or so. I need to stitch in. I've got some quite exciting things, including a few things to put in the appendix, like the circuit diagram from inside one of the guitars and a block diagram of Frank's on stage rack. So there's a few little nice things that I've been sent by people.
Ah, that's great. See, we're obviously that is the book that everybody is waiting for.
Well, I'm not sure exactly under what label it'll be published, but it will be published. Dweezil wrote the foreword. He's still looking forward to seeing it as well. So hopefully we'll sort all these issues out. It'll be out next year in one shape or another, with one label or one other.
Didn't Dweezil think it had been published a couple of years ago?
Dweezil just asked me when I last saw him what happened to it.
Okay.
Obviously, our first big topic is something that we've been actually meaning to address now for a while, but we're finally getting the opportunity to, which is that... the one and only Mrs. Gail Zappa passed away back in September. I don't really... I knew she was ill, but I didn't know to what extent she was ill. And I was sort of surprised by the news of her passing because I thought she would literally just live forever. I don't know about anybody else. Did anybody know here what... No,
I had no idea. As I say, it had all gone very quiet in our communications with her, but then all year I've been dealing with one of her staff rather than directly. But
yeah,
the sort of from about March, April, it had gone very quiet, and so I was perhaps not terribly surprised. But because I'd seen photographs of her at various events, and she didn't look as well as she did when I last saw her when she was over for the Tournament of Hills, when she seemed sort of quite... You know, bouncing health.
Yeah, like...
Have they ever announced an official cause of death or anything? I mean, everyone... Ahmet said it was cancer, but do we know what of? Or is that just not going to be told? If, you know,
I saw lung cancer. I didn't know if that had been retracted. I saw that somewhere official.
I saw that somewhere also.
Yeah,
was my understanding.
You know, it's kind of strange because she didn't really smoke all that much, did she? I mean, she wasn't a smoker when you knew her, certainly.
Not in the same way that Frank was perpetually. I get the impression almost certainly she was a committed smoker like everybody else back in the day. In fact, here's a little story that she told me. It was funny, I'd have these sometimes conversations with Gail, and she'd be talking about the book or licensing or trying to sting me for a ridiculous percentage or whatever, and we'd start having these very heavy conversations.
Yeah.
And then we'd sort of get past that point, and then she suddenly become very friendly and start telling me all sorts of things, and we'd have fantastic conversations, and I really did like her. She was telling me one time about her first date with Frank, and she sort of met him and liked him, and he was going to take her out somewhere. So she was in her little apartment looking out the window and saw him coming in, and she had to quickly sort herself out because she'd had her hair in curlers. And because she was so poor, she said she'd made curlers out of cigarette packets and elastic bands. So she had her hair all done up with these, I don't know, round packets of Winston's or whatever, which she was frantically pulling out, watching Frank coming up the driveway in his tight, flowery trousers that he used to wear in those days. A little story of young love there.
That's great. See, she could be nice when she wanted to be.
When Gail was in a good mood, I think she was tremendous company and, you know, very entertaining. You had to pass some heavy bullshit tests to get to that point.
Yeah, I think we all did at one point or another, right? I mean, I had to jump through a few hoops to sort of get on her good side, but, you know, she did, she did a couple of really nice things for me, so, you know, she did credit me on the in the credits of the Greasy Love Songs album.
Yes, indeed.
She did not have to do that, so that was really nice of her. But yeah, she was. I always found her to be, you know, as I always say, I always found her to be very fair. And I don't know, Andrew, did you get the impression that she wasn't happy about the book you wrote, or do you know if she ever even read it?
I know that she was sent a copy of it, but I think her only interest was to see if there was anything copyrighted in there that she could sue me over, or the publishers over, but there wasn't anything in there that was copyrighted, so that was the end of the story. And she never paid for the copy of the book either.
Oh. Did you give her a promo copy?
No, I didn't. I think I've said before how I did write to her before I'd even written a word and said, you know, I'm doing this. Do you want to be involved? Do you want to talk to me, and didn't get a reply, so I just wrote the book and it got published. And that was it.
Yeah,
I mean that was one of the problems, I think. If you deal with Gail, and it's something that Pauline Butcher told me as well, if you caught her, that's fine, and you get some traction, be able to talk to her. But then there might be a year, or I think when I was writing the book, I'd met her and she said, "Yeah, the book's a great idea, very enthusiastic." When she'd come over for the Roundhouse gig.
Yep.
Oh,
table of contents, and I sent her two sample chapters, and she came back almost straight away and said, yep, fine, you know, go ahead, you have our blessing. So I did some more, and about 6 weeks later I sent her some more material, and I never heard anything, and I never heard anything for about a year and a half. Yeah. And I just assumed I'd inadvertently done something to completely piss her off.
Well, I think I went to Dweezil.
She was just busy with something else, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I went to Dweezil at one point. Remember? If you remember that,
yeah.
Talked to him. Was that during that period where nothing was happening?
Exactly so, yeah. And so you were my last hope. You sort of suddenly got through to someone again. I can tell you the story of how that led to me eventually going to LA.
Yeah.
So you got me in touch with Dweezil. Via you, he got a copy of the book, which he liked, which was tremendous. And then following on from that, when he was coming over here, that was one of the times when the gold Les Paul, the stolen one, had surfaced again under auction over here.
Yep.
And there was some talk about him trying to sort of get it by legal means, and so me and Deep Indochima, some of you guys know, between us, we were sort of trying to gather what evidence we had between us.
Sure.
And sent that to him, which didn't come to anything, but anyway, as a result of that, I had a brief telephone interview with him, and then I met him after that show. I can't remember which one it was, but one of the shows he did in London. And
Barbican one, was it?
Yes, it was. That's right. It was the first Barbican one. So I talked to him briefly at the end of the show, and he was very enthusiastic. I said, well, what about me coming over to photograph the instruments and so on? And he sort of said, well, when were you thinking? I said, well, what's happening in sort of January, February? He said, yeah, that should probably be all right. Nobody's touring. And he sort of said, that'll be fine. So I said, okay. So I booked a flight. And me and my son came over. And we just had a Dweezil's number. We'd also had spoken to Thomas Nordegg, and he said, we could go around his place and see his amazing equipment as well. So we met Thomas. Then went around to see Dweezil. Saw his little home studio, had an interview. He showed us the Hendrix Strat and everything. It was a lovely time. And I said, okay, so when can we go to the UMRK? And up at that point, I had no idea that he'd fallen out with Gail.
Yeah.
At all. None whatsoever. And at that point, Dweezil said, do I have to be there? And I sort of went, well, no, it would be nice.
Strange question, did you?
You know, what do we do? And he says, well, okay, he says, well, here's my mum's number, and I'll tell her you're here and give her a call tomorrow. So I went, okay. So I called her the next day from the place we were staying in, and the phone rang, and Gail says, what do you mean by going behind my back and talking to Dweezil?
Oh, boy.
And that set the tone for the next half hour of the conversation, and it was quite intense. My son had to go and leave the room. He was finding it so nerve-wracking. And we talked, and I was explaining. I said, I had no idea I was going behind your back. I thought he was, everything was sort of, you'd be understanding, you'd know this was happening. Anyway, we had this conversation. And she started saying, well, maybe we can do something. I don't really know, but maybe we can. Call me tomorrow. But in the meantime, this was like a little bullshit test, I think she'd give me.
Yeah.
He said, in the meantime, he said, call me tomorrow, same time tomorrow. He said, in the meantime, he says, people say that Frank Zappa used to call his music air sculptures. Mm-hmm. And he never said that. I want you to find out where it came from, or where it was first said. I can't remember exactly how she phrased it. So I went, okay. I think I said, I'll ask my people. and they went off the line and promptly called, I think you, Scott, and
yep.
Andrew, certainly. He said, you know when this first came out? and did some frantic Googling or whatever, and we found out. So then I spoke to her the next day, and she said, how are you? And I said, well, fine. And I can tell you that there was an article in Paris Match that Frank did interview in 1960, whatever, where he said, playing is like making a sculpture out of air. And and there was some other vague reference, but he never used the term air sculptures as such. Anyway, that was a sort of interesting little test. And then she sort of said, oh, that's interesting. And then she told me the story about the fact that she'd invented the word. And actually, this is a bit of interesting insight. So the story, according to Gail, when Frank was building the UMRK and he sort of dug out the basement and he was starting to get it built and so on.
Yeah.
And he'd already started, and Gale had the job of sorting out the planning permission with the LA planning authorities, because Frank had just started anyway. So that was Gale's job, apparently. And they were sort of getting to the point they didn't like the idea of it. It was a studio in a residential area, and against sort of their various ordinances and laws. And she was trying to get this pushed through. And then she quoted the precedent that one of their neighbours was an artist, a sculptor, and he had a studio in his place on Woodrow Wilson, where he used to have sort of classes of students and so on, doing sculpture classes. And so she said, well, if you're allowing a sculptor there, I mean, he's just making air sculptures. And that's what she said. And anyway, she managed to sort of get them to relent, and they gave him permission. So a significant part of what made the UMIK possible is probably Gale's harassing the LA planning authorities, I guess.
Well, if anybody was going to be good at that, it would be her.
Yeah. So then we had, you know, so things had warmed up a little bit by then. But then she said, but, you know, you can't just turn up on my place and want to take photographs. You know, I mean, these are rare instruments. I don't really know you and you, whatever, you know. So I sort of said, well, could we bring Thomas Nordegg with you? Because we'd had a very nice evening a couple of days before around Thomas's place.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe. And again, I had no idea that Thomas and Gale hadn't spoken for years because she'd got in the sack. I know that. But she said, yeah, okay, but you'll have to pay for him. Well, okay. I called up Thomas, and bless him, I said, Thomas, you know, I told him what was happening. He said, would you be able to come and act as our handler? And like, he's such an amazing guy. And he just said, well, let's think, it's Friday. I'm doing the NAMM show for 2 days with Steve, and then I'm doing something to do with the Grammys on the Monday. But yeah, Tuesday I'm free. Yes, I can do that. Bless him. So I called Gail back and said, okay, Thomas has said he can help. When can we do it? And she said, well, we could do Tuesday, but I thought you were flying back on the Tuesday. I said, no, we're flying back on the Wednesday.
Yeah.
So finally it was, okay then, okay. Well, you can come at this time. Amazing. So right on the last day of our book tour, we were there.
I met him because he was sharing the house with a girl that invited me over for dinner, and she drove us to the airport, and he had told her, I'm coming home unexpectedly, obviously. The promo tour got canceled. Don't bring anybody. And she said, okay. And she said, come on, we're going. And so we go to the airport, and I was thinking about this the other day. It's so funny because I was standing there, and this guy comes toward me, and he had a briefcase, and he was all grubby, wearing these skin-tight jeans and this wretched T-shirt that had holes in it. It was rags, and I could smell the peanut butter in his mustache from, you know, 5 feet away at least.
God, that's attractive.
I know, it's so attractive. It was everything I had dreamed of my whole life, and it's so not. And he had a briefcase, and so he kept walking toward me, and I thought, this is like, he's not going to stop. There's no way. He's just going to walk right through me. And so I'm like, I'm holding my ground. So I plant my feet firmly on the floor of the airport, and he comes up and he takes the briefcase and he knocks my knees with it, holds it out, knocks my knees. So I'm like, I'm not backing up for you, so I have to do this. And then he puts the briefcase down between my legs on the floor and just says, you're cute. I'm like, really? This is it? I didn't say anything. There was nothing to say. We didn't even speak. That's the first thing you said to me, and we didn't even speak. And then I went home, you know, with him and his friend that he shared the house with, and that was that. Spent the first night, and when I woke up in the morning, these voices, very loud, very prominent, like a whole chorus, were saying, this is it. If you walk away from this, we'll never be talking to you again. I'm like, no, that's not how it works. Yep, you choose.
Okay, so destiny, a sense of destiny.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm sorry it's not that easy for other people, but it was that easy for me.
So we turned up the next day, met Thomas outside, banged on the door, Kurt Morgan showed us in, took us into a little kitchen where we could have some coffee, says, I can't do anything, I can't show you in yet, I've got to wait till Gail comes down, but she wants to see you first.
Mm-hmm.
So we're having a coffee, and all the time I could hear Gail talking very animatedly on the phone upstairs. You could hear this, you could hear what she was saying. And so we were waiting for there for about half an hour, thinking, oh, what the hell is going to happen now?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sort of something, huge eruption of galeness as she comes rushing down the stairs, sort of all bubbly and everything. And most apologetic, and sort of, hi, I'm so sorry for having kept you late. I really am, but I've been on the phone to Ruth Underwood, persuading her to come and have an interview with you. And then gave me a big punch in the arm and said, don't say I'd never do anything for you. And bless her. And then took us into the studio and said, okay, you can take photographs here, here, and here. Don't take photographs there, that's personal. Do this and that. And there was Kurt and one of the other guys. And there was a whole load of guitars in cases lined up already and everything. And she said, yeah, off you go. Fire at will, she said. And the interesting thing as well is when she sort of, in our conversation, she'd said to me that all this stuff about, well, you can't just turn up and expect to do this. And, you know, you can't expect my people to do all this stuff at your beck and call. You've got to bring someone to help you and everything else. And, you know, but in fact, having spoken to Kurt, she'd had them working for about two or three days beforehand, preparing this stuff, getting the guitars out of storage, getting everything ready. And she'd had them getting everything ready for us, even though at the time I thought I was still negotiating to go around. So you have to go for these little tests. But she was absolutely lovely that day. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, she phoned me back. I said, guess what? I says, I've just been looking around in the Joe's Garage storage and I found all Ruth's contact mics from her marimbas and all this other stuff. But you've got to see it. I said, I've got to come over again, haven't I? She said, yes, you have. So I flew out again. And she let me go into the Joe's Garage storage thing. And she had one of the guys who'd helped rebuild the UMAK studio. He was there at the time and he showed me the Frank's collection of microphones, which I hadn't been out to see before and so on. And once again, she was lovely, she was very helpful, and good fun. But it was just very interesting, the sort of hoops and the tests that I had to go through, if you like, to prove sort of the integrity of my intentions, I think was the word she used. Well, and I think that applied to a lot of things she did.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, in my case, it was actually pretty simple. I mean, you guys all know the story, but I had, much like you, Andrew, actually, I had emailed her before I started working on my projects in 2006, and I just said, this is what I'm doing, and hope you don't mind, all that sort of thing, and I didn't hear anything. It actually took me till, I believe, 2008 before I heard anything, and the only reason that I heard was because by this time I had met Dweezil and Joe Travers, and I had mentioned to them that I had not really heard anything from Gail, but that, you know, I would like to make sure everything was sort of copacetic with her. And so one of them talked to her for me, and then she sent me an email, and the first few emails were not all that nice. It was sort of like, you're writing this stuff and you don't know anything about me and you're saying things about me and I know you are and all that stuff. I said, well, Gail, you're actually not in the books at all.
Right.
You know? So that was my first encounter. But after the first few emails, she started to calm down, and she eventually looked at through the books and said, well, there's nothing in here that violates my copyright, which, you know, if you've ever, you've all seen my books, it's, you know, the album covers alone would technically do that. But she gave the thumbs up for it. And the only thing that she asked me to do was to not title the books after song titles anymore, because they were common law copyright is what she said. That's common law copyright. That's mine. You can call it whatever you want, but just don't name them after song or album titles. I said, that's fine. So that made me wonder what she must have thought when Pauline came out with a book called Freak Out. But she had one bad spell with me in the few years after that, and rather famously, she offered me a job working for her in L.A., but she never did tell me what the job was. So we can only speculate it. I think it had something to do with some sort of official bootleg series that she wanted to launch. I think she sort of came to view me as the bootleg guy, which was kind of odd, but yeah, strange, isn't it? But
I remember about that same time I was offered. Oh yeah, she said that she was going to. There was going to be a special part of the Zappa website devoted to Zappa's gear. She wanted
I remember that.
Take my website and somehow incorporate it into their site, and I'd have an email address of mick@zappa.com, which I thought would have been nice.
But yeah.
Again, it never ever happened. I never even got to speak to their webmaster, whoever that was, who was supposed to be organising this, but this dragged on for about a year and never happened. I think a lot of what motivated Gail was very clear to me. She was very much concerned about being in control of everything that went out, so she'd want to see this. She'd need to know this.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the... When we were over there, and I was sort of in the... There's a little office next to the studio where they answer the phone and do various stuff, and there's a couple of computers there, and both of them had a big sort of sign on the top of them saying, "Has Gail seen it?" Usually a reminder that you don't send out an email or anything until Gail's seen it, I guess. and that was how she rolled. That was how she ran things.
That doesn't surprise me, actually.
Michael Mesker is the website guy, I think, isn't he?
Oh, right, I don't know. We never
Michael Mesker?
Put together.
Michael Mesker, yeah, he works for Fry as well, doesn't he? Does Fry's website. So.
I'm
pretty sure he's the what do you call it, moderator at Zappa Forum and everywhere else. Yeah. Does the work.
Yeah. And again, that sort of stopped me in my tracks a bit, and so while I was waiting for all this to happen, I did nothing on the website, so my content is pretty much static from about sort of 2.5 years ago. So
yeah.
I'm going to again try and put some fresh stuff and maybe re-engineer it a bit once I've sorted things out with what's happening with the book. I've got loads of all sorts of odd little things that I can put in there, and so hopefully that'll get revived as well now.
It was September, the leaves were gold. That's when our hearts knew that story untold. We were young lovers, strolling near the fountain of love. Fountain of love, fountain of love. And we were young lovers, strolling near the fountain of love. Love, ooh,
What did you all think of Gail's handling of the Frank's music and all that sort of thing? Say, for example, because it took her a while, didn't it, for her to really start getting product out there and point the way forward in terms of releasing stuff that Frank himself had not mastered for release. But she did eventually do that, and certain projects came out that would never have come out had Frank lived. Things like the MoFo Project Object and Lumpy Money and things like that. Certain archival releases probably would have never have come out. And what did you all think? I mean, were you satisfied, Zappa fans, subsequently? I mean, you know, nobody's ever satisfied.
Throughout that process, where we were all, the announcement would be made for a lot of those releases. We're talking post Ryko Disc then,
yeah. Right?
So a lot of those announcements were made, and then we were, everybody was excited and giddy waiting for them. And then, you know, those delay of games, the whole, I'm sure you guys remember the phrase, before there's frosting on the pumpkin.
Yes.
And we received that many a times. And, you know, Roxy, of course, being the largest burden of those, that phrase. But a lot of those things that we would wait for, and she was very, very, very particular to the way that those were released. I remember Hammersmith particularly, supposedly the big delay of game there was the balloon, and getting the balloon with Frank's, you know, stash on there. Mm-hmm. And then the party hat that she had, which was, you know, for the toilet. And while they're all cute and gimmicky and reminded me of We're Only In It for the Money and the little badges that we would receive.
Yep.
Were they worth the delay of game that we were receiving in those, with her being very particular on that? That was the discouraging part for me, was just, you know, that you have your fan base, you can release them, you know, there were people who were willing, and we went through that proposal too, of paying a subscription. Mm-hmm. to get a certain number of releases per year. Was it that important to everybody that the balloon came with it? And I, for me, the answer is hell no.
That always struck me as a bad idea anyway, because the balloons are going to perish, aren't they, over time, and ruin the CD anyway, the packaging.
Actually, it's true, yeah. Yeah, the rubber will eventually just stick to your CD.
Yeah, so get rid of it now.
I mean, you know, I wish I had my T-shirt that came with the old Masters box, but that's about the only you know, gimmicky little thing that I want. Did anybody buy the old Masters box when it came out?
No. Yeah. I've got it.
I've got
it.
Yeah. I've got
it.
Yeah, I've got that as well, yeah.
Just to... No, too small for anyone over five. But.
I can't. Yeah, mine came with that T-shirt that said "I bought the box" on it, and like an idiot, of course, being a teenager, I wore it. So now I don't have it anymore. Not that I couldn't fit one arm into that now. But that's the one thing. You know, I don't think Gail gets enough credit on some of the releases that came out. Were just remarkable. Yeah. I thought.
I agree. And I think, yeah, I know there was sort of long periods of wait, but I mean, generally some of the stuff that came out, I think, was really wonderful. We wouldn't have seen things like Everything Is Healing Nicely.
Yep.
I think someone was talking about that recently, and that was, if you like, very specifically a message from Gail to the fans in that. That was a fans record.
Yeah, I agree.
And so I was very happy with it. I liked all the Dommage, the Joe's Dommage, whatever weird... you know, rehearsal tape records as well. I think, again, they were very much for the fans as well as the other stuff. So I really liked what came out when it eventually did. Some of it I would have seen packaged differently. Some of it was a bit too expensive. But mostly I was thinking, this is great. You know, particularly I think when there was a period for a few years when we were getting about two or three albums a year, there was a, you know, a good live record that we hadn't heard, a Joe's, Dommage, yep. Chris, whatever, plus something else from the Vaults. It seemed to be coming quite well for a few years, and I was delighted with it. At that point,
Yeah, I think we need to, I mean, you know, obviously a lot of praise has to go to Mr. Travers down there in the vault, because he did, you know, put together a lot of that stuff. And I'm not sure to what extent that Gail had a lot of input other than approving it, but I do think there were certain things that she asked him to do. And so he did them, and that was great. But you know, that's the, you know, I have to throw in some praise for Joe here, because he doesn't always get the credit he deserves. But he's, you know, he's remarkable where it comes to knowing this, his stuff, and knowing where it all is in the vault and all. That's not a small task.
No, absolutely.
I mean, were you able to go to the vault? Mick?
I wasn't allowed into the vault itself, and I believe that was at the time because Kurt dropped a hint that there were things in there I couldn't see, and I suspect I would have seen in there lots of boxes with Universal written on them before it had been announced. I think that was probably what was around at the time.
Ah, yes. Okay,
but,
well, that makes sense.
But Gail thought the world of Joe. She absolutely did. And there was a time when I was there speaking to Ruth, and then Gail popped in, and Ruth was asking us that, you know, and they talked about Joe specifically. And said, you know, what on earth would you do if Joe ever left?
That's a good question.
Well, he can't. He's sold his soul to me, sort of thing. And but yes, you know, she totally knew that without Joe, you know, everything would stop. There wasn't really any obvious anyone in this seals talent and so on. And she absolutely thought the world of him, I'm sure of that.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt. And he, you know, the feeling was very much mutual. And he, you know, I mean, they had a really good working relationship. You know, it was a very solid working relationship. And you know, he was, you know, you do need somebody like that down there, because I can't imagine. You know, I mean, he's put in what, 22 years now in the vault.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, that's quite a long time. And to know where everything is, because if you think about it, even with 100 releases or 101 releases, you're not even scratching the surface of what you could put out there. And somebody
has to actually.
Oh, what'd you say? I'm sorry.
We're up to 102, aren't we? Because I think
102.
The Roxy soundtrack is 102.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, 102. Okay. My God. I pity any new fans just starting out. Start with Freak Out. But,
but here's an opportunity.
What'd you say,
sorry,
Scott?
Andrew. I was just going to say, here's an opportunity, though, now that there has been a change of the guard, that we could have a lot more of these releases. I question a lot of what Joe may have had sitting on the table that was ready to be released, especially just looking at things as you know, obvious to me, as like the road tapes, as we had a volume one and then a volume two. Why go through voluming things if it ends at two?
That's a good question. I think there will be more road tapes.
Yeah,
I think there was a hint of that, wasn't there, in one of the obtuse messages that came out in the middle of last year.
Yeah. I think you'll see more of that stuff. I think there'll be more of those, you know, the Project Object series. There will be more of that stuff, I believe. I mean, it's just so much stuff.
Let's skip to kind of much further down the end of the line, right? Which is after Frank's death, right? You are now in a situation of being the gatekeeper, the holder, the supporter of all his work, all his life's work. I'm going to talk about sort of the middle section later. But you said to me earlier that when he died, it was kind of impossible to watch him, listen to him, you know, take on board the fact that he'd gone. But he was still there every day, every day, every day. And it took you a long time before you could become what you are now, which is such a fierce defender and detailed forensic person about how his work should be managed. So that period when he knew he was going to die, and you did, and then he died, what happened then in terms of you understanding his work and him? Well, one of the things that we were talking about earlier is, you know, you have had one understanding, or, you know, several, a combination, whatever. It's the big conglomeration of an understanding about Frank's work and his music. And then when he died, there was just this vast silence that landed and consumed my whole life. It just ate it up, and I was just left in a corner with this big, giant silence. And then, you know, gradually you begin to let that stuff in, because I can't avoid seeing Frank in my children's DNA, you know, and their smile and their tweak of an eyebrow and a hand being raised in a particular way, and a Dweezil's hands on the guitar, because he has, his hands are so like Frank's. And things like that, you know, you see him everywhere you look. But I couldn't watch film, and I couldn't listen to records for the longest time. So sort of about 10 years in, so I was perfectly willing to sell the catalog, which is what he told me to do. So I said, okay, you guys deal with it. And that was with Ryko. And then sometime later I realized, oh my God, they're making up stories about this person. They're stealing an identity. They're recreating something that never existed and never should exist. And so then I got serious and started watching things. And I had the benefit of Joe Travers coming into my life, because he really saved my ass, because what I couldn't look at, what I couldn't listen to, he could. So I'm really grateful to have a Vaultmeister who's in the house somewhere.
Joe's somewhere here.
Yes, he is.
There he is. We'll come to you okay. Later, yeah. If we can.
And I don't think he knew that how much he saved my ass. But so eventually, you know, I came to terms with this. I didn't think of it as a legacy. I thought more about it as a theft of Frank's identity, and that I was now responsible for protecting that, and for also, because I continued to own the publishing, because in those days the sync rights were all important and controlled really the catalog. So then I decided, okay, I have to figure out how I'm going to manage this. And I realized the central idea behind copyright, I'm just going to go and say this, the central idea was something that Frank was very specific about, and me as well, we were both really hardcore patriots. I know it sounds corny to say that, but we were. And one of the things that I recognize even in Varese's music is the same idea, that he came to America because it was a free country. You had the right to pursue happiness. So if you, among other things, but you had the right to be known for the person that created this music in this way, and no one could mess with it without your consent, without your permission. So that became the central idea, and I began to realize pretty quickly that without copyrights, which are protected, I don't write these laws, I don't make up the rules. Copyrights are what are protected by the Constitution of the United States, and then by conventions such as the Berne Convention, which all these countries in the Western world and, you know, wherever else, subscribe to. And if you show me a country that does not protect music, that makes it illegal to listen to music, that has only state-approved music, I will show you a fascist state. So what you're really doing when you protect your copyrights is you're protecting against a fascist state. And in the United States, when people are so powerful, able to buy whatever they want, whether it's a judge here or an ice cream cone there, they've now ruled that a corporate entity can be considered a human being and have the same rights, although I don't know how that works exactly, you're setting a dangerous precedent for the idea of democracy, which was, according to Frank Zappa, our greatest export, and it no longer is. So for me, I'm just defending democracy in protecting the copyrights on the one hand, and on the other, protecting the identity of the person who wrote it and the integrity of the work that he wrote in the way that he intended it to be performed. So that's it in a nutshell, really.
this tape of Frank with Eric Clapton and people.
That's right, yeah.
Which is, maybe that will be a...
It's to be used for the new... it was possibly to be used for the new upcoming...
Documentary.
Yes.
Hang about, which new upcoming documentary?
Yeah, it's true. There is more than one now, isn't it?
obviously, you know about the Zapped, which has been renamed, Eat That Question, which is going to premiere at Sundance in January.
Yeah.
Yes, I saw you post that, yeah.
Yeah, and that was something that Gail was talking to the director at the Roundhouse about. And it just sort of disappeared.
Well, that's an official project, yeah?
It was, yeah, certainly was. And it was exactly the same as the Alex Winter thing, where it's, you know, we're going to let him use unseen footage, let him have access to the vaults. This seemed to be given to this German guy, Thorsten Schutt.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just sort of went quiet. It was going to show at some festival a few years ago, and it didn't. I thought, oh, obviously something's happened there. I tried writing to the guy, but he never replied. And then suddenly, a couple of days ago, they announced that it's going to appear at the Sundance Festival. It seems like it's not now got the backing of the ZFT, but he did at one time.
So you don't think? So you don't think he does have the backing?
Well,
of the trust
he was given access at the time with the, you know, the view that he would be allowed to issue this documentary, but I mean, it could just show at the Sundance and disappear again, couldn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I wonder if he submitted it. I don't know. When do you have to submit to Sundance? I think it probably could this have already been in the works before Gail passed?
Oh, yeah. It was. I mean, they showed clips at the Roundhouse in 2010.
Oh, okay. I see. I was, unfortunately, as usual, all the good stuff happens away from here, so I wasn't there.
I mean, but wasn't that project from quite a long time ago, Andrew, as well? Like, it wasn't fresh at the Roundhouse. That's not the impression I got. I thought it was something you'd done quite a few years previous.
I don't know. It was kind of revealed at the Roundhouse, anyway.
Yeah. But I don't think it was a new project then.
Nah.
So
it had been working on it for some time, yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't complete. A few years later, it was going to be shown at a festival 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. It'd be very interesting to see. I get the impression that Alex Winter is going to be a much more substantial piece of work, I guess.
Hopefully the ZFT will remain on board throughout, and that'll be it. The thing, though, we're talking about Joe and the relationships here. This is something that will probably... It's always interested me. Obviously, Mike Keneally, big friend of Joe Travers.
Yep.
But Dweezil and Mike Keneally don't get on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you read my interview, but I asked, you know, what's the chances of Mike Keneally ever playing with you again, Dweezil? And it was, well, not in the foreseeable future. Sort of like never. and we obviously there seem to be problems between the brothers, Dweezil and Ahmet. Possibly now trouble between Joe and Dweezil.
Well, I don't actually think there is any real trouble between Joe and Dweezil. I think that, Joe left the band, you know, we've talked with, I mean, Scott Tunis made reference to, you know, why he thought Joe might have left the band and all that sort of thing, but I don't think their relationship necessarily was strained. I mean, I think that they have a much better relationship than, say, Keneally does with Dweezil, and I'm not even sure what the full story behind Keneally and Dweezil was, but Joe just didn't really, I mean, really, kind of, it boils down to, as I understand it, or as I've come to understand it, Joe just didn't really like traveling that much, you know? I mean, he wanted to do his other work, he wanted to be in the vault and all that stuff. You can't really blame him that much.
that was Keneally's thing, wasn't it? Keneally wanted to have a career outside of Z.
Yeah, I guess that would be true. So, you know, I don't know how long Z would have kept going, even with him in the band, you know. I don't know that it made that much of a difference, you know. But, you know, Dweezil had to come off the road, regroup, and then, you know, I guess he didn't have to do Zappa Plays Zappa, but fortunately he did. And now he's going out on tour on his own.
Yep.
So, is he going to be playing in England, do you know, Dweezil?
I heard there might be some Via Zamata dates next year after the US tour.
Yeah, I don't know when he is planning on going back out with ZPZ, but
That will be, the February tour will be with ZPZ, won't it? But playing Dweezil solo material.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, well, I don't think Joe regrets leaving the band. I think he was just tired, you know, he was just tired of traveling. You know, he didn't want to, you know, and the band was on the road constantly, you know. It's fair to say that they probably toured more often even than Frank did, probably, you know. Because the way it is now, I mean, you're not making money from CD sales or anything like that. So you have to keep the band on the road in order to, you know, and it's a trap. It becomes a trap. You know, but his shows, I don't know how, they must do well over there, right? No, his shows always sell out here.
Yeah, there was a time where it seemed to be getting smaller and smaller venues, but now, you know, having just played the Festival Hall, which was pretty much packed, wasn't it, Mick?
Yeah, indeed, yeah. He must have done all right
about
that.
Yeah.
Did he begin there at the festival? Was it Festival Hall or Albert Hall in 2006?
Albert Hall was the first one.
That was Albert the first Hall. One. Okay, so the Festival Hall was a good, you know, that's a good venue.
But
play.
It was the only UK show.
Yeah.
It was the UK show, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's doing fine. I'm glad to see that he's getting out and doing some of his other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see what, you know, whether how well people respond to it, but I would think they do pretty well. What did you guys all hear the new Dweezil album?
Yep. Yes.
What did you think? The panel.
I haven't heard it yet. I've only heard a few bits of it. I haven't heard the whole thing.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, some good stuff on there, definitely.
It's a bit disconnected and odd saying that, considering Frank's material obviously was extremely disconnected as well. I mean, Lather coming to mind with all that, but yeah, it just seemed like just a bit odd to me, especially with the Dragon Master thrown in there. I know that was a big undertaking for Dweezil and important to him, but. Maybe just kind of that whole game of which one of these doesn't belong.
Yeah. One of these things is not like the others.
Yeah, you know, and points for trying. I've always loved and appreciated his solo thing, because I miss the camaraderie like no other of him and Ahmet, and it's a shame that can't be there anymore. I love Ahmet, I always felt, put the eyebrows on things correctly, but...
Yeah.
So I miss that missing piece, but, and it's nice to see him. I can only imagine how that is, doing a tribute project to your father all the time, and I mean, I'm sure there's not a night that goes by with him without having a discussion with somebody backstage about his father and having to live in those footsteps and trying out his own things. I just felt like this is more a collection of ditties, you know?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably fair. I mean, I don't know what, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of artists now that feel that albums don't really have a place anymore, and it is all about these sort of disconnected little bites, you know, little bite-sized pieces of music now. I don't know how much of that drives that sort of thinking, But yeah, I enjoyed it, you know, for what it was. I was glad to see him get back to it, because when I've talked to Dweezil, I've tried to avoid the subject of just endlessly talking about Frank, you know, and would talk about anything else, you know, like he'll talk about how I should probably exercise someday. So.
Well, Megan's, I think he lost a lot of weight after hooking up with Megan, didn't he? He suddenly became quite trim and toned.
Yeah, you got that PX. What is it? PX.
PX90.
Is that what it is? Yeah, he was extolling, or more than once, he has extolled the virtues of that to me. So.
Get down, good to get down, all the way down. She do your laundry, she do your tire,
chop a little wood for the fire, poke it around, if it died down, oh yeah. She was a fine girl, she go up in the morning, she go down in the evening, all the way down, she do the dishes, the wishes. Silverware too. She make it look brand new when she get through. Oh yeah. She was a fine girl. Out of this world. Lovely smile with a bucket on her head, full of water from the well, she could run a mile. Oh yeah. She puts a little drop, did she stay on top? Her head was kinda flat, but her hair covered that. She was a fine girl. She didn't need no school, she was built like a mule with the farm signed up. It was no kind of job she could not handle. She could get down, could get down. All the way down. Woo! We need some more like that in this guy town. We need some more like that in this guy town. We need some more like that in this guy town. We need some more like that in this guy town.
If we can sort of drag things back to the topic, I one thing in talking to Dweezil,
yeah,
and it's something that I'm sort of I wonder what is going to happen now, because although Joe is a great custodian of the recorded material,
mm-hmm.
and Kurt is doing, still is, as far as I know, doing amazing stuff with all Frank's written music, which is a vast amount that hasn't yet been surfaced. I mean, he spent about a year helping collate the stuff at the 200 Motels, but I've seen some of the other things he has,
yeah,
and there's some wonderful manuscripts there that just, I don't know what, you know. Anyway, he's on that. Nobody is particularly looking after the studio, looking after the equipment. It really, you know, some of the stuff we found there was actually in a very, very sad state, because it had just been put into storage and left there. There was the lovely old Hammond organ,
mm-hmm.
in a flight case that had partly, the foam had deteriorated. Another one of the old Yamaha synths, we went to open the flight case and sort of poisonous carcinogenic foam that had turned into dust started pouring out, and the tech guy, he said, quick, shut that, quick, we're not opening that one yet. And I don't know what's going to happen to that, because it wasn't particularly well cared for. Since once they closed Joe's garage down as a rehearsal studio, it was just a storage thing. I don't know if anyone's, you know, the UMRK has barely been used since Dweezil moved out.
Did they
what's
use...
going to happen to all that stuff, and if anyone's actually particularly interested in it, apart from me, which is a shame, because I think it should go to a museum or someone who will curate it properly, because I don't think that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, well, something has to happen to it. You got to photograph the Sinclavier, didn't you?
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah, but, I mean, the Sinclavier is not working. It's most of the Sinclavier, when I was there, was in sort of a closet with a sort of glass door that you could sort of just about open if you persuaded Joe to move his seat. It was in the same room where he does his messing around with tapes and stuff. And it was not actually working at all. Toddy Vega was there as well. He's another person that Gail had invited over to speak to me, bless her. And he was talking about it, and he says, no, we've got some things working, and we've got to the point where we can play some of the stuff, and you know, that's how they got Monkeys at the Mamaison and the other things sort of together, but the actual synclavier itself is not, I don't believe, functioning. Well, it might be, but it's not in a situation where it can be wheeled out and plugged in.
So, Mick, you're saying that the monkeys was transferred from a synclavier that wasn't already sitting around and archived?
No, no, that's what I mean. It was already archived. So they're not in a position to sort of recreate, I don't think. They've got some pieces.
Right.
Todd Vega's got his own synclavier anyway, so I think he may have used that in some cases as well. I know he said he had to bring his along when they were doing the Yellow Shark, because Gail had bought... That's right, interesting. So Gail... Frank had his synclavier, and then he had a massive upgrade to it, which was Gail's birthday present to him. I guess that must have been his 50th birthday?
Yeah.
Perhaps. And so she spent whatever it cost to get the biggest spec synclavier that you could, and completely upgraded the system with the new keyboards and, you know, all this memory at sort of, you know, $50,000 a megabyte, whatever it cost then, and so on.
Oh my goodness.
And so he had all this stuff, and apparently the power supply wasn't good enough for it, and it kept failing and not working, and so Todd actually brought along his model for a lot of the work with the Yellow Shark. But all that equipment, some of it's there, some of it's, you know, there's a few choice pieces sort of on show in the studio, but a lot of it is just in cases, I don't know where, in basements and that. There was some pieces in a very sorry state. You know, some pieces were quite well cared for, the famous guitars, I guess. I do wonder what will happen to that side of it, and eventually what will happen to the vault. I mean, we really need someone like the Smithsonian or whatever to maybe have it in the same way that the Grateful Dead archive got given to the university, you know.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, you know, the Grateful Dead, because, you know, certainly, a lot of their vault is out there for public consumption, but, you know, I would hate to see the tapes in the Zappa vault deteriorate before they could be archived digitally, and I don't know that a lot of them are. You know, I actually don't know the answer to this, but I would imagine that there are a lot of tapes that are still not archived digitally. And although I think that they pretty much know what everything is by now, you know, there's still not a lot of stuff that has to be discovered per se, but there's a lot of stuff that I don't think has been transferred digitally because, you know, who's got the time?
That's the problem. And some of the stuff, there are very few machines left that will play it on, like the stuff that's recorded on the Sony digital recorder, which they have one working there and another one I've seen in storage. There's not many of those around now still working.
Let me just land on this thing about, you know, you suddenly realise that if you don't protect both his work and his story, then he becomes a distorted character in history. Yeah. Which is not fair, not right. And actually, you know, we have that in so many contexts, don't we? But you also then become the professional widow. And that's a hard thing to be, because just what I notice is that people aren't very nice to and about professional widows, even though, you know, you are forced to be one out of responsibility. And, you know, Yoko Ono has talked about this. Stockhausen's two widows talk about this. The idea that by protecting the right of the person that you loved and knew, that somehow you become a problem for other people because you're basically standing in their way, I suppose. Do you find that there is a lot of aggression against your determination to do this?
Yes, but I realize that aggression is coming from a very unenlightened source. So, you know, you just keep doing what you do.
What do you mean by unenlightened?
Because if people really understood first of all, let's question. The people that attack me primarily actually are guys. You know, they're men of various ages who just can't get over the fact that I get to say what happens with his music, and I get to determine, you know, they think that I made it up, or, you know, that I'm operating under some law that shouldn't exist, or whatever. But if in voting against my right to do that, you're voting against democracy, number one. Number two, who are you to question my right? Why are you questioning it? Is it jealousy? Well, if it's jealousy, then you have to say, what are they jealous of? Really? Intimacy, probably. That's exactly right. You're exactly right. They're jealous of the intimacy. And what does that imply? Do they all want to sleep with Frank Zappa? Because I think he knew that, and that's why he wrote those lyrics. It said, you think that I dream through the night of holding you near me? No, he did not, and you should really question your motives for why you attack me.
Nobody here is like that. But I think that it is an interesting thing because there's a sort of idea that only girls and women kind of scream, faint, and you know, go and swoon over male rock stars. But you know, that is just not true, is it?
No, the feminine side that they wish they could deny comes out, and I've seen it so many times with guys literally swooning on the floor at his feet. You know, they would kiss his shoe if he invited them to. It's really, I mean.
But he didn't.
No, he did not. Yeah. And he really tried to help them wake up from whatever it was they were experiencing.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways.
Where have you been all my life?
Working with Frank.
Oh, okay. I guess that was worthwhile.
But recently, I don't know.
Yeah. I know what
I still
you mean.
Work for him. The pay is not as good as it used to be.
But you don't get back talk. No. You don't get someone say, "Don't you dare," or whatever that was. What did he say? How dare you?
How dare you?
Yeah.
He said, "How dare you?"
So you don't get that from anyone.
Yeah, but it was good practice for him, I think.
I was going to say, and this is really sort of throwing it back at Andrew, we should probably discuss the aspects of Gail's behaviour that has upset particularly European fans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about, you know, sort of.
Yeah, I guess we can't really avoid it, can we?
Definitely, and the tribute bands and what Gail has done to them, and I think you should speak, Andrew, on this.
Okay, that's one of the things. If you look at Wikipedia of Gail, what's the big thing on there? It's about her lawsuit against the Art Society and Zappanali, which didn't end very happily for her because they ultimately were cleared of all charges. And that as I understand it, Zappa Plays Zappa haven't played in Germany since about 2007, 2008, whenever that was all finally done and dusted and the Art Society were not found guilty of any crime. But I think that, as I understand it, they've paid all of the court costs, and as soon as a member of the Zappa family sets foot in Germany again, they're going to get a bill thrust in their hand.
I had no idea. I never heard that one before. Oh boy.
Yeah, that's my answer. It might be completely wrong.
Oh, sorry, German fans. That'll probably never happen then.
I can't see how they could hold Dweezil liable for that anyway, because he's distanced from that thing now.
So. Yeah, yeah. In 2006, when they played the Albert Hall and all of the European dates, the Art Society were following them around with big signs, we have the spirit, you have the genes, come and join us, sort of thing. But that didn't happen, so Dweezil wasn't obviously happy about that. One day you might play there.
Well, that'd be nice, because there's been a lot of people who you would not think would have played at Zappanali, but have.
Scott Tunis has been there twice.
Yep.
Harry Bozio.
I mean, but wasn't Duke there?
George Duke was there. George Duke and John LaPonte playing Some of King Kong, which was about one of the best things there. Even though they were very under-rehearsed.
Well, that's all right.
And that was very soon after George's wife passed on as well. So that must have been quite hard for him to do.
Yeah.
Erskine was there.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
There's been a lot of people. Even Steve Vai sent a message of support when it first... I think several years ago now, when they put the bust up and everything.
Yeah.
What do you think about the bust? Do you think the bust is horrible-looking? Mick, you've seen it up close.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous. I'd say Gail's view, it looks nothing like him. He looks like a little gnome. I'm totally with Gail on that. But I don't think the other bust either is also any good. But this one in particular is tiny. It's only sort of two-thirds size. I think it looks ridiculous.
It looks like a gnome.
It's hardly a great memorial, put it that way.
I haven't seen it up close, but it looks like a gnome now. No, whenever I finally do get the chance to see it, that's all I'm going to hear in my head now.
Sorry, that was Gail's words that she put in my head. But I mean, I've been to Zappanali and had a great time. It's fun, and there'll be some great music there. I've also seen some dreadful tribute bands there as well. And
I've seen some of those.
Going to a festival, I'd rather see a few good bands and then maybe some other music that's possibly influenced by Frank, or just the sort of stuff he might have liked.
Well, they've gone around these sort of through these hoops before, where they've less to sort of 60% Zappa, 40% someone else, and then people didn't like it; they wanted more Zappa all the time. So they do get these bands who get together for a couple of weeks just to play Zappanali in there and disappear.
And I think this is one of Gail's things as well, that she...
It wasn't...
Motivation, she particularly wanted Frank to be remembered for the stuff I think she knew he cared about mostly in his later years, which was the orchestral pieces. And although she liked what Dweezil was doing, and when she spoke to me, although they'd fallen out, she was still praising Dweezil as a musician and guitarist with
well,
great motherly pride, but she wanted to see
Frank... Dance me this. be this sort of pay a lot, you know, say a lot about doing the police, haven't they? Yeah. That may have been written about 5 years ago.
Yeah, but generally that was her main thing. Her real motivation was seeing events like the event at the Roundhouse.
Yeah.
Which at the Roundhouse I think was wonderful. That was, you know, quite a good, well-rounded event with an orchestral evening and a Dweezil concert and something else, you know, in films and so on. That was nice, and I didn't feel there should have been a lot. It would have been better with a lot of Zappa tribute bands.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen DVDs of a number of Zappanelli performances, and yeah, some are great, some are brilliant, and yeah, some are definitely, as you said, dreadful. You know, there's a few lesser ones, but you know, I mean, I can understand. See, you remember when Dweezil was on the ZappaCast, and he was talking about he himself does not have a huge problem with tribute bands and all that sort of thing. He just wants to see the music played correctly, which I don't think is unreasonable. Because the argument being that, well, you know, Frank changed his arrangements and stuff all the time, and then Dweezil said, well, yeah, but that was Frank doing that, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't up to anybody else to do that. And I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, do you think that bands should be allowed to sort of express, they should be allowed to have their take on that music, or do you...
I don't think it particularly matters, and I think if you'll get bands like the Muffin Men, who...
Or Ed Palermo.
You know, and they...
Yeah.
Yes. And they're both great in their different ways, and I think both of them, the Muffin Men particularly, have got the right spirit behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a great professional band as well. They're not an amateur band. And that's what I actually really hate, is seeing, you know, and sometimes it's my friends, so I'm not going to name any and bless them for having a go. But I don't particularly want to see that sort of thing, because the music, whatever sort of band Frank had, it was always very well rehearsed, extremely well presented, and the Muffin Men are very professional, Ed Palermo is very professional, this is good music. I don't particularly want to see someone singing Bobby Brown Goes Down not very well. And I think Gail particularly didn't want Frank to be primarily remembered for Dynamo Hum and Bobby Brown.
No.
Those are the things he wrote to pay for the orchestral music.
But it is interesting with, and that's part of my perspective too, is just being a latecomer to Frank's music and it being posthumous releases for me, of seeing those, the cover and tribute bands, and knowing some of them personally, and seeing the struggles that they went through with Gail's cease and desist conquest throughout that process, seeing so much of her energy and effort going in that direction. When
I was going to say, I mean, that, the whole idea of these guys playing this music was to try and keep it alive. With Gail trying to clamp it down on it and stop it happening, it almost could have killed it. You know, that's the frustration I have.
Right, and you know, there seems to be I had seen her or heard of her making two different claims. Number one was the very obvious one that we've talked about already, that she's going after them for that it's played correctly, as Dweezil had pointed out, and I think that's important too. And as Mick just explained, you know, and it stinks when some of them are your friends and you see, you know, things could have been done a little, hey, maybe you should rehearse that one a couple more times. But the claim that they're making money off of the ZFT was completely wrong. I mean, a lot of these were doing Kickstarters and trying to take money. They're losing money on the thing, all for the love of Frank. And it was all about Frank and the love there. And then to see a cease and desist occur, or to get threats personally from her over that, was really a shame and disheartening. I really don't think that, and who knows, but I really don't think that's the route Frank would have taken at that point.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't, you know, Frank did not mind Zappanelli, which existed, by the way. Yeah, in what was the first one? In 90, 91?
91, I think, yeah.
91. So, and that was being advertised actually in Society Pages, which was a kind of semi-official fanzine. So, you know, he didn't mind that.
The other side of this, of course, is that it's not Gail that's been, it's not something that she alone has done. Frank himself tried to get the Viva Zappa book stopped. Dominic Chevalier wrote a book, and Frank didn't like anything to do with that, and had Society Pages write a sort of page, an apology about it, and saying, you know, don't urging people not to buy it.
Which was funny because that book had come out years before, right? I'd had it for a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I mean, suddenly you're reading Society Pages and this little thing turns up that says, do not buy this, it isn't authorized. Well, I think anybody who was going to buy it would have bought it already.
it was an expanded edition or something, wasn't it?
Was it? Maybe it was.
Yeah, I thought I'd already got it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd certainly had it. So, I mean, you know, I would have ignored that anyway.
And obviously Frank was famously, you know, going after record labels and all sorts throughout his career, wasn't he? So it's not like Gail thought of this all on her own. Go after people and try and sue them and do whatever else.
Well, that's true. Frank, there was a kind of semi-famous story about Norbert Obermans who did the Zappalog, if you guys remember that book.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you all know this story, but he wrote the original Zappalog in, I think, 81, I believe. And that was self-published. And then Rhino picked up the book for sort of major distribution in 82, and Frank Norbert had gotten, or Nobi as they called him, had gotten taken a copy of the book to Frank on one of the shows on the 82 tour, probably in Denmark. And as you probably know, on the 82 tour, Frank was generally in a bad mood. You know, he was, if you listen to the tapes and everything, he was not particularly in a good mood that entire tour. Well, Norbert brought this book to Frank, and Frank looked through it, and he just said, "Where's my money?" So that was the first thing, like, you know. And then I think he sued to have the Zappalog taken out of print, but he was very anti Rhino because they signed the Grandmothers. And the original Grandmothers lineup, they put out that Looking Up Granny's Dress, album.
Yes.
So he blamed Rhino for, you know, I mean, he basically saw Rhino as sort of trying to bootleg him and all this other stuff. And he was never, I mean, he was always sort of litigious like that. I don't know, just didn't really want anybody writing anything. I mean, I don't know that he had a problem with any bands that were playing his music that weren't the Grandmothers, who he actively disliked, I guess is the nice way of putting it.
Well, what about the controversy with you know, Frank's request of Watermelon and Easter Hay being marked taboo?
Yeah, and it is...
Did Frank ever say that?
Supposedly.
Right, through... similar to Gail asking Mick for his sources, I know that I've heard it through, well, Frank said, but I don't know if I could cite a source.
No.
Dweezil might have said it. Did Dweezil say it anywhere?
Did it first appear in the Frank Zappa Plays the Music of Frank Zappa?
That's what I was just thinking, yeah.
I think that's where it is in the sleeve notes about, isn't it? And I can sort of understand, okay, they might want to keep those three in specific memory, because you'll never hear anyone else playing it as well. It's a lovely little melody, Watermelon, but nobody's ever going to play it as well. So I don't know. I'll make a point, I think, which I've said to you guys before, and it's something we tend to lose track of sometimes. Gail was very aware of it, is that there are Zappa fans, and there are Zappa fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Zappa fans... I've got 102 records, and they've got every bit of material, and they're totally engrossed in the same way that Deadheads are and so forth.
Yep.
And there's actually an awful lot of other people who are just Zappa fans in the same way that I'm also a fan of, I don't know, Miles Davis and Soft Machine, and I've got a lot of their material.
Mm-hmm.
I've got got no idea even if there are Facebook pages. I don't even know if there's a festival. I don't know what bootlegs are out. I just buy what product comes along. And I sort of brought a couple of friends to the Moir Festival.
Yeah.
Who were just Zappa fans with a small F. And they had each maybe 10, 20 of his records. They didn't collect all of them. They liked him a lot. And they were quite amazed to see there was this a fandom thing going on. And as I say, there's a big market. I guess some of those people might be buying the Roxy DVD, who probably haven't got all the other rather poor quality DVDs like I'm sure we have. So, and Gail was quite aware of that, you know, that there were the mad fans, the ones who she had arguments with, and the other ones who had no idea, just noticed peripherally that every now and again there was new Zappa material coming out, and isn't this great? And it's much better quality material than other posthumous stuff from people like, I don't know, the Hendrix estate and so on.
Yeah.
So there's that side of it. I mean, I think Gail also, she didn't care who she picked a fight with. I mean, she had a big fight with Steve Jobs, for example. She wasn't just taking on little tiny German festivals or little tribute bands. She'd go for Steve Jobs and say, fuck you, you know.
It's true.
And I mean, quite rightly so. I totally agree with her on that, you know. Because he's fucking ruined music.
Yeah. Well, give us.
He stayed at home listening to vinyl because he knew it sounded better. What a knob. Anyway.
Sometimes, you know, you have to wonder, but.
Dispersed. His guitar and style is well rehearsed. He stands and shouts. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. And disagree. Well, no one durst. He's the best, of course, of all the worst. His bones been choking, been greenish drops. In the light of the iron sauces, where the torture never stops. The torture never stops. The torture, the torture, the torture never stops. Are they zero? never been explained since at first it was created. But a dungeon like a sin requires not but locking in of everything that's ever been. Look at her.
You know, it's funny because when Gail passed away, how many rock star wives do you know that got the media coverage that her death did?
Yes, true.
I mean, she got a lot of media, you know, decent media coverage for somebody who, you know, on the surface of it was a rock star's wife. You know, and that, you know, that just shows you how much of a remarkable woman that she really was. You know, do I agree with the decision to go after bands like Project Object by serving them with cease and desist papers whenever they went to try to play a club? No, not really.
No.
That was
on the
rough.
Other hand, you know, right. I guess having the energy and so on to put things like 200 Motels on got a lot of publicity for Frank. It's a mixed thing, you know. I mean, yes, as you were saying, Scott F., you know, I'm sure a lot of fans missed the opportunity to hear music because of the action on the tribute bands. On the other hand, Frank Zappa's profile is probably raised higher by the big projects like 200 Motels, like the Roundhouse Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why she had such a big name, because she had still kept Zappa name out there in some way, whereas if she just allow it to go any old way, I don't know, there might be a sort of lot more casual bands around and so on. And so I've got, you know, no objection to them at all. I think it's a great shame that Project Object had the hassles they did.
Yeah.
But whether Frank Zappa would be any better known because of that, I'm not so sure. Nobody would have had the time or the money to put on the big orchestral shows and so on.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, I know. I can speak personally, and Project Object definitely is near and dear to my heart friends and musicians. But I know personally, from the Chicago standpoint, countless people that I brought to those shows that I wouldn't even say, like you talked about the uppercase and lowercase F of fans. That they wouldn't even qualify to that. That they just knew a couple because they were, you know, bothered with it by me to be exposed, and then all of a sudden found a whole new appreciation, respect, and not to mention the conceptual continuity of it all. We always talk about putting the eyebrows on things, or I do at least, and following along with those things. Where ZPZ, good example, where. Not quite wanting to touch those political pressure points with a 10-foot pole, where I think Project Object is a tremendous example of hitting on those exact spots. Let's be topical to the modern day, just like Uncle Frank would. And I think that it was through those types of tributes that really could kind of, from a grassroots perspective, really get people into it all. And ZPZ did that as well, through more from a musicianship point of view. I think there's a grave importance there. But Mick, you're right. There could very well be people out there that maybe Carnegie Hall fell into their lap somehow, and they heard that, and that pulled them in, and a whole new generation.
Yeah. And different sort. So, there was recently a small concert in London, classical concert, where there was a couple of pieces played, A Perfect Stranger, and yes,
mm-hmm.
and that was done by a very, very good chamber orchestra called the Britain Symphonia. And talking to some of the people there, and there were some people there who were there because they followed the Britain Symphonia, not because of the Zappa music. Me and my mate Jeff and Clint Walker, obviously some other Zappa fans, but a lot of classical fans who follow these people, and they were just interested in all the pieces they played. And certainly one of Gail's, and I should think Frank's wishes, was that he is now accepted as a sort of a serious American 20th century composer. That is now accepted, and she got that. That was one of her driving things, I think. And that's what she achieved.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually really, because it does take it, you know, I mean, when Frank passed, he was the guy who wrote, you know, Dynamo Hum, and he was the guy who wrote Dancin' Fool and Bobby Brown and all that sort of stuff. And, I mean, now, certainly the image that you see of him in the press, he's an American composer.
Yeah.
And that's very much a Gail thing. I mean, I don't, you know, Frank referred to himself as a composer, but I don't know that he ever believed that anybody would, or cared maybe, that anybody would take him seriously as a composer. You know, he may have at some point have just given up seeking that kind of respectability or whatever, that kind of status. And
I don't think he cared about the status. He just wanted to hear his orchestral music played, and it was just stupidly expensive and impossible to rehearse and so on, and every time he had a go at it, he lost even more than he lost on touring. So there was always that difficulty.
Yeah, I mean, so it was as simple as that. I mean, he did say at the end of his life that he didn't care about being remembered, and I wonder to what extent. I mean, that may actually have been true. He may not have cared about being remembered.
Maybe not, but I mean, I think if you look at the sort of the videos of him when he sort of comes on and conducts a little bit of the Yellow Shark,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, he was so happy, finally, you know, after having given up on finding musicians who could play the stuff that was even too complicated for his bands, and he could only do it on the single ear, suddenly he found these real musicians, totally engaged, playing his stuff, and you could see he was happier than he'd been probably for, I don't know, I can't remember the last time, just those moments on stage where he's conducting and that, and you can see, you know, you can see Frank's face when he's totally happy that he's suddenly got a band that's doing something wonderful.
Ladies and gentlemen, here he goes, Peter Randall. He seems to be disgusted. Whatever. Reader, last song. It goes. Von Deiner, Max Bank, Sohn, heute Abend hergekommen ist unser Hermann Kretschmer. Wollen wir reinlassen?
Welcome to the United States. This form must be completed by every non-immigrant visitor not in possession of a visitor's visa. Type or print legibly in pen in all capital letters. Use English. Item 7. If you are entering the United States by land. Enter land in the space. Land. If you are entering the United States by ship, enter sea in the space. Do any of the following apply to you? Answer yes or no.
No.
A. Do you have a communicable disease?
Come, no.
Physical or mental disorder? Or are you a drug abuser or addict? Tell me, Bill. Yes or no?
No.
Louder.
No.
B. Have you ever been arrested or convicted for an offense or crime involving moral turpitude or a violation related to a controlled substance? Or ever being arrested or convicted for two or more offenses for which the aggregate sentence to confinement was 5 years or more? Answer yes or no? Or being a controlled substance trafficker? Immoral activities. Answer yes or no.
Yes or no.
Thank you. See. Have you ever been, or are you now, involved in espionage? Or sabotage? Or terrorist activities? Genocide. Or between 1933 and 1945, were you involved in any way in persecutions associated with Nazi Germany or Italy? Answer yes or no.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And welcome to the United States!
Thank you very much. Here they go. Brent Tucker and Herman Kretschmer. Back on stage, Peter Rundle.
Frank described it, and I heard him have a conversation with Beefheart on this very topic, and there is a point where the object of the game is to get to the place where you can play the perfect note. And so much has to go into that before you can play the perfect note, because first of all, you have to know that it's possible right here, right now, to do it, and then you have to do it at the same time.
Yes.
And you can't play anything. Circumstances are so that you can't play anything but the perfect note. You have no choice.
Yes.
And that's the ultimate
goal.
Mastery of composing in the moment.
Yes.
It's
yes.
very zen.
You know, another, not that it's the cheeriest of subjects, but while we're talking about passings, we had one of our listeners pass away yesterday. Kirk Lewis, who was Captain Kirk on the Zappa boards and the ZPZ boards.
Mm-hmm.
From California, he had suffered a stroke a few months ago, and he passed away yesterday. So I know that he was always a big fan of the podcast, and always sure to put his likes on our on when we would post things and that. And I know he listened to a bunch of the shows. So
yeah, I had messages from Kirk. So.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. Kirk was always a great guy. He was a reader of mine. He was a really. He would ask. He would just send me messages to ask me questions if I knew one thing or another. And I'm like, well, I really know nothing, but you know, stuff that, you know, not behind the scenes stuff, but just, you know, just kind of general knowledge stuff. And you know, but I was always honored to be asked, you know. It's always nice when people think you actually know something. That's what Gail said to me in our first email correspondence. She said, you know, you think you know all these things, and you know nothing. And I said, Gail, I don't know anything. I'm trying to find out things. That's why I'm writing them. I think that won her over a little bit, you know.
It's interesting. I had a lot of... lots and lots of feedback and corrections and so on in the book, apart from just, you know, requests to remove the names of people who are out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them actually showed a lot more insight and understanding of what was going on than perhaps Gail gets credit for.
Yeah.
The rest of it also is just very much her wanting to protect Frank and so on. I remember that there was one piece I wrote, famously complained about one of his keyboard players noodling away on the Mini Moog when he was going wooty wooty on the Mini Moog when he had this wonderful synthesizer behind him and so on.
Yeah.
And I was writing a piece about that, and I just sort of mentioned that Frank had said this, and I put in brackets, rather unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
And Gail said, you can't put that. Frank meant it. He wasn't being unfair. This guy was ruining his concert by noodling on the Mini Moog, and he should have been playing on the synthesizer, and, you know... Frank was not being harsh, he was totally right on this. Okay. <You know. laughs> So, very sort of caring about, you know, correcting me, if you like, about any... I couldn't put any sort of inference on what Frank was thinking, which is actually right. She'd picked on inferences where actually they just come from me, and I hadn't known. But she did have a lot of knowledge about it, which is interesting.
You know,
I think I'm going to throw one other thing in that you might want to use as a quote or whatever.
Mm.
But it's something I said to my son. So after we'd sort of finished the session,
yeah,
and we were just talking to her, and everyone was very sort of relaxed and so on. And she sort of, a couple of times, you know, you'd look at her, and suddenly she would do her big, big smile and the twinkle in her eyes, and she'd say something very witty, because she was very sharp, very witty. And she could swear like nobody. She was really fucking brilliant at swearing. She could fucking swear. She was great. And I just sort of looked at that, and I looked at her, and I was sort of thinking, Frank would not have stood a chance.
Yeah.
He could. And he sort of more or less admitted that. He didn't stand a chance. She was the one for him, because she had it all. And you can see the early pictures of her, and she was a great beauty.
Mm-hmm.
But coupled with the foul mouth and the and the twinkly smile and the strange, rather off the wall intelligence. I can't imagine anyone else have actually lasted any period of time with him the way she did. So,
yeah, it's true. Oh, yeah, and I have a lot of perseverance, you know, didn't you? But I, you know, it's probably true of a lot of, you know, rock star wives, I guess you might call, quote unquote, rock star wives. But I think in Frank's case, it was most especially true because Frank built, he sort of built his world and populated it with people who in general were not people who were going to question his authority or his control over things. And the only person who I think he really allowed to question him ever was Gail.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, he needed to have somebody there to, you know, maybe to yell at him once in a while. She could, you know, we've heard stories about that. And she
she's probably the only white person in the whole world. Yeah.
Probably, yeah. And he, and I think he respected her for that. You know, none of the other, you know, is look at all the other people that were around the house. You know, look at even in Pauline's book, you know. I mean, Gail may have been somewhat meeker when they had met, but she quickly grew into, you know, her role as, you know, the alpha female in that household. So, you know, she was, like I say, you know, she was quite a remarkable woman.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. But before we go, I figured I'd give you the rundown of the music that you heard in this episode. Now, the first thing I wanted to point out was that there are some interview segments with Gail from two different sources. And the first of these was from her appearance at the South Bank in London in 2013. This was an interview done live on stage to promote the 200 Motels performances, which have just been released as the official ZFT album, 200 Motels the Suites, now available from barfco.com as well as many other fine sellers. And there were also a few interview segments dropped in there from an interview that Mick Eakers conducted with Gail Zappa and Ruth Underwood at the Zappa household in 2012. In addition to this, we heard the following musical selections: I Ain't Got No Heart and Love of My Life from Barcelona, Spain, 1988. Fountain of Love from the original 1968 version of the Reuben and the Jets album. Stolen Moments from the Broadway the Hard Way album. Fine Girl from the You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore Volume 1 album. Secular Humanism from the Feeding the Monkeys at Mame's Own album. The Torture Never Stops, featuring Gail Zappa on various Grunts and Groans from the Zooter Lures album. Welcome to the United States from the Yellow Shark album. Watermelon and Easter Hay from Barcelona 1988. And to round off the episode, we will play you a song that was never released, and in fact, we don't actually have a very good recording of it at all, but it was a song that Frank wrote for Gail in the mid-70s, and it's called Solitude. So with that, we say farewell to Gail Zappa, and thank you all very much for listening to the ZappaCast. Happy New Year, folks, and we will see you next time. That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The Zappacast was produced and edited by Scott Parker, Andrew Greenaway, Mick Eakers, and Scott Fisher. Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com, and if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers. And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com. And for more information about Scott Fisher, you can go to fishersflicker.com. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R-S. FLICKER.com. Scott is a very wonderful musician and songwriter, and you can check out some of his music at that website. If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at SNET.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway, Mick Eakers, and Scott Fisher, this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.